Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. With 60 heads of state planning to attend the memorial for Nelson Mandela in South Africa, we'll begin with the global outpouring of tributes from both those who Mandela helped free and those who resisted freedom, democracy, and majority rule in South Africa. Dr. Mweni wa Muyu, a professor of political science at Winston-Salem State University and author of The Pitfalls of Liberal Democracy and Late Nationalism in South Africa, joins us to discuss the economic and social challenges that remain to be addressed in the new South Africa. Then we'll examine the latest front groups funded by the Koch brothers, a tax-exempt charity, the State Policy Network, which is a so-called free market think tank campaigning to cut public sector wages and pensions, eliminate income tax, replace public education with vouchers while opposing Medicaid and efforts to combat global warming. Lisa Graves, the executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy, joins us to discuss the role of the Kochs, Kraft Foods, and Searle Pharmaceuticals in appearing to promote local interests while funding a national template to radically alter government. Then finally, On the 1 year anniversary of the Newtown School massacre, Amardeep Kalika joins us in the studio to discuss the lack of progress on gun control and legislation to reduce hate crimes and mass shootings. The son of the president of the Sikh temple, who was murdered along with five members of his congregation by a white supremacist, Amardeep Kalika is running for Congress to unseat Representative Paul Ryan, in whose district his father was shot. And joining us now is Dr. Mweni wa Muyu, who is a professor of political science at Winston-Salem State University. Dr. Muyu is co-author of A New Paradigm of the African State and the author of The Pitfalls of Liberal Democracy and Late Nationalism in South Africa. She is also a member of the Executive Council of the Association of Third World Studies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Mweni wa Muyu.
Thank you.
And obviously the whole world is mourning the death of Nelson Mandela, and there's a National Day of Prayer in South Africa, and I think something like 60 heads of state are going to South Africa, along with the current president, Obama, and former presidents, Carter, Bush, and Clinton. And just to touch on the idea of George W. Bush being there at the funeral, and that, of course, brings up this whole idea of how he's being mourned universally by those who he helped and those who hindered him in his struggle to free Africans. Some of the statements that Mandela made about Bush at the time of the Iraq War were pretty stinging, but I guess we forget that side, right, at this point.
What
is it about this duality and or this dichotomy of memory, and why is it that there are these totally different narratives and totally different reasons why people remember him? The victims remember him for one reason and the victimizers for another, it appears.
Yeah, I think it's mainly because of the reconciliation that was promoted as a result of his efforts, and the conflict was avoided in South Africa, and that is why many people look at that and really see it as a major moment in history.
Well, it was a major moment in the, I mean, wasn't the country plunging in that interregnum in 1991 to 94 before that first election? There was a lot of black-on-black violence between Inkatha and the comrades of the ANC, was there not? I mean, the state Afrikaner government, of course, were behind the scenes encouraging Inkatha.
Yeah. But because of the efforts that were done, carried out not only by the African National Congress, but other movements, that was the major conflict was avoided. It would have been worse.
Well, exactly. I mean, was that not the motive of the Afrikaners to stir up divisions between the ANC comrades and Inkatha in order to basically discredit the idea that Africans could rule themselves?
Yeah, but it didn't succeed, because in every region, even within the Afrikaners, there were groups that were against that. So that didn't succeed, and that really shows the triumph of the human spirit.
Well, nobody denies that. And to that extent, what is being honored at the moment is, I think, very appropriate. But I think there's still so much of the history that is hidden or clouded or conveniently forgotten. And you deal with, of course, the history of these two concurrent nationalisms, African nationalism and Africana nationalism, in your book, Dr. Mweni Wa Muyu, The Pitfalls of Liberal Democracy and Late Nationalism in South Africa. For example, I don't think most people know that the Africana political elite, led by Dr. Vervoort and Johannes Voster, both of them, one was in jail during World War II as a Nazi, and the other one was on the lam, was he not? Wasn't apartheid born out of a Nazi kind of ideology?
Yes, it was. And the tactics that were used were very similar in every way.
And I think both of those leaders of the Afrikaner movement in the post-war, from the beginning, from 48, when the Republic of South Africa was led by the nationalist parties, I believe both of them spent time in Hitler's Nazi Germany.
Yeah, but the issue now is looking at Madiba's role when it comes to the transition, and that time of history becomes, it was crucial, especially for that transition period. So it is for the future generations that we'll have to address the other issues, like the economic issues that remain in South Africa.
Well, that, of course, is, well, as you point out in the book, that the white minority government still maintains economic and military, largely economic and military control. And some of the statistics about the reality of today are not very encouraging. White-led households typically earned, in 2001, white-led households typically earned close to 17,000 more than their black counterparts. And by 2011, the disparity had grown to nearly $30,000. And I mean, there are lots of statistics along those lines. So what is your basic critique then, Dr. Muyu?
The economic inequalities, as you have pointed out, continue to widen because apartheid was based on inequality, both economic and social. And it really required a very strong state to intervene to address those economic issues. And now there is also inequality between the African elite that continues to be very rich material-wise compared to the majority of the people, and in a very short period. So that has to be addressed if we can really keep the legacy of Madiba alive as far as equality economically is concerned.
And, of course, the black majority comprises 80% of the country's 37 million people, but the white minority, who are 10% of the population, control roughly 70% of the economy. What percentage does this new black elite control? Do you know that?
I haven't checked the latest data, but it is very small and in a very short time, which is what is troubling, because 1994, next year, 2004, it is amazing to see the amount of wealth that has been achieved and the distance between the elite and the common person who is very poor.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Mweni Wa Muyu, who's a professor of political science at Winston-Salem State University. Dr. Muyu is the co-author of A New Paradigm of the African State and the author of The Pitfalls of Liberal Democracy and Late Nationalism in South Africa. She's also a member of the Executive Council of the Association of Third World Studies. So what do you think is at the root of this disparity? And it's worth reminding ourselves, of course, that we live in a country that in spite of all of our jingoism about freedom and democracy, we're essentially living in an oligarchy and our democracy is up for sale, it would seem. But that aside, what do you think is driving the disparity in South Africa?
Patrick Bont pointed out in 2005, the post-apartheid government inherited the structure of apartheid without really major changes in the economic and the security sectors. And once liberal democracy was adopted, it was very difficult to really transform that inequality because we are looking at the corporate sector to introduce change, and the corporate sector is there to make profit.
But also, don't you have the economic reality of South Africa is that it's dependent on mining and agriculture?
Yes.
So it's a resource-based economy that ranks 28th in the world. In 2012, its GDP was $384 billion. One of the paradoxes that I've been told, and I'd be interested in getting your response to this, is that along with the human tragedy and obscenity of apartheid, there was also the fact, and of course the rebellions in effect began in 76 in Soweto by the young school children who were being forced to learn Afrikaans, the language of their oppressors. But one of the theories that I've heard is that had the Boers, the Afrikaners, not been so boneheaded and racist, and had they allowed, and I guess to some extent the same argument applies with the Israeli occupation of the Palestinians, that had they allowed the African majority decent education, that South Africa could have become an extraordinary economic powerhouse that would have, in effect, dominated Africa. Is that a valid theory?
But the argument would also have been applied to the Belgium Congo, where the Belgians didn't train as many Africans, and it was a colonial situation. So, yes, in every colonial situation that occurs, where we find the dominating group always taking care of its own economic interest and security.
So would there have been an alternative? I mean, it's somewhat pointless talking about, you know, these kind of what-if scenarios, but was there an alternative? Should Mandela have stuck closer to the ANC's Marxist roots and had a real revolution in South Africa?
Given the realities that time, Madiba made the best moves, and history has already proven that. So it is for the next generation to really introduce the economic changes that will be required to move South Africa to the next stage, where it becomes the real rainbow nation for all.
And do you see signs of that? If you mentioned that there's a new elite that is obviously very comfortable with the status quo, I understand that there's a lot of crime, there's a lot of social ferment, I guess, bubbling under the surface. What's your sense of how the scenario that you just outlined of more social justice and economic opportunity, how do you think that could be realized?
So far, it has the new government, given what it inherited, has really tried. Like you just pointed earlier, the statistics that were given in the New York Times this morning, over 2 million houses have been built since then. But we also have a very high unemployment rate for the youth, especially in urban areas and in the rural areas. And that will be a very big challenge as far as achieving equality or something closer to meeting those needs is concerned. But to do that, the elite has also to try and curb its material wealth so that the gap is not so wide.
And in terms of the elite, what's your sense of how socially responsible they are? I mean, I made the point earlier, Dr. Muyu, that here in the United States, we're rapidly becoming a plutonomy ruled by an oligarchy. And they don't seem to be giving up anything. You know, you have fast food workers on strike around this country. Bank tellers are not getting a living wage. We're becoming a feudal economy here in the United States. We're heading in the opposite direction to the one that you are urging South Africa to head in.
Yeah, it will be very difficult for South Africa to do that, especially given the power of the different interests that are concerned, that are involved. But as the ANC continues, and also the other organizations, there will be a lot of pressure from below, because these people who need economic justice will continue pressuring the system. And given time, the system will have to address those economic needs.
So I started out by talking about the kind of expropriation of Mandela in a way by the West, and not that he doesn't deserve in any way the praise that he's getting, but I just find it a little uncomfortable that so much of what he said and stood for is being sort of glossed over, in the sense that, you know, he and the ANC basically were a movement of the left. The right, the Thatchers and the Reagans of the world, did everything they could to hold back the clock, if you will. But I recall some of the statements that Mandela made, where he said, for example, about the United States, if there's a country that has committed unspeakable atrocities in the world, it is the United States of America. He was talking about its decision to drop the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And then at the time of the Iraq War, he said, and this is in the context of former President George W. Bush going to the funeral, or the memorial, this is what he said about the U.S. intervention in Iraq, or the war in Iraq. "What I'm condemning is that one power with a president who has no foresight, who cannot think properly, is now wanting to plunge the world into a Holocaust. All he wants is Iraqi oil, because Iraq produces 64% of the oil in the world. What Bush wants is to get hold of that oil." I guess that's not going to come up at the funeral, right? The real nature of those scathing words from President Mandela.
No, it won't come up at the funeral, because it's the time, like in the oral tradition says, it's time to honor the memory. So I doubt that will come up in the funeral.
Well, I guess I'm being a little unfair here, but what's your sense then of honoring this man and what is going on in South Africa today with its National Day of Prayer and the obvious outpouring of genuine grief as well as genuine admiration?
Yeah, I think it is wonderful, because growing up throughout the continent, we always grew up with Madiba as the beacon. And what remains to be seen is whether African leaders can emulate his behavior as far as reconciliation is concerned, not only towards racial minorities, but other ethnic groups and political opponents, so that we all belong to the same humanity.
Well, it is. You can make a real contrast here, surely. The death of a great man on the one hand, and there's a country dying in the middle of Africa, the Central African Republic.
Yeah, which is really very astonishing in, as far as the conflict is concerned. And we have seen the same thing in the DRC. So compared to the days, to 1994, there are a lot of conflict and a lot of hatred, also xenophobia and all that. So the legacy would really be to make home for everyone, regardless of religion, race, or ethnicity.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Mweni Wa-Mwuyu, what is it about Mandela that, you know, they had him in prison for 27 years, and there's some interesting stories coming out now about his relationship with his jailer. And, of course, in the museum that they have in South Africa, they put up a glass replica of his a transparent replica of the cell to let people realize how small it was. You can only make three paces in this little cell where he was kept for 27 years. But somehow or other, he was always the leader of that country. What was it about this kind of underground reality that existed there? How could a man that the oppressors decided to kind of lock up and hope to forget be remembered all of that time? And the minute he came out, you know, the whole nation, in effect, I mean, it took from 91 to 94, obviously, before he was officially the leader. But it was clear that he was the leader. And I just don't understand that mechanism. It's so interesting to me.
Yeah, because in so doing, we also have to remember the other leaders like Oliver Tambo, Walter Sisulu, Govani Mbeki, and of course, the others who also were on the other side, like Ari Gwala and Steve Biko, all these organizations that were involved. But it is Madiba who acted as the major factor in reconciliation. But we don't forget that he's part of a major movement and other organizations that were also fighting against apartheid.
Well, clearly there were a lot of people on the outside, and they were making sacrifices, and of course Steve Biko was murdered. But I was just curious to get a sense of how it was that he was so much in everybody's consciousness. At the same time, the obviously the purpose of the apartheid government was to try and have his memory erased. But it, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I just was curious to know how everybody knew who this man was and they knew what he stood for. I guess it means you can't extinguish an idea, right?
It is also in one of the memoirs when they were negotiating, a lot of the young people didn't even know who he was, but the ANC kept that memory, especially through Winnie Mandela, which is never acknowledged.
I see. So that was, you think, because one of the objections that a lot of the more conservative Africans had towards the comrades was that they were you know, disrespectful of the elders in the same way that I guess you know the Red Guards in China during their revolution were. I mean, obviously the Red Guards were pretty brutal in terms of beating up elder you know the so-called bourgeoisie, but. What's your sense of that of what was going on there in within African society?
Oh, there was a lot of tension within different groups, but the beauty of it is that compromises were reached. Some of them that were a very long-ranging effect, like economic and security ones, and which have to be addressed by future generations of South African leaders, because those will continue really being the main factors of dissatisfaction within South Africa.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Mweni Wa Muyu.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Mweni Wa Muyu, who is a professor of political science at Winston-Salem State University. Dr. Muyu is co-author of A New Paradigm of the African State and the author of The Pitfalls of Liberal Democracy and Late Nationalism in South Africa. She's also a member of the Executive Council of the Association of Third World Studies.
The peddlers and the meddlers, they buy and they sell. They destroyed your city, they'll destroy you as well. The lecherous and treacherous, a hair meant for leather, each of them bigger than all men put together. Sluggers and muggers, wearing fancy gold.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Lisa Graves, the Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy and the publisher of AlexExposed.org, PRWatch.org, and SourceWatch.org, where she just released an expose of Pete Peterson and his campaign to fix the debt. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for Nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Graves.
Thank you so much, Ian, for having me on.
And in terms of this new front group that the Koch brothers, Kraft Foods and Searle Pharmaceuticals and others are behind, which has got a very generous $83 million war chest, the State Policy Network. I guess you see them then as another kind of stealth group. They say that they're a a sort of think tank, you know, a free market think tank, but they're not really interested in the local issues that they say they're interested in. But you're saying that they are creating a larger national template to essentially change government in this country.
Well, I think that's right. This is a group that most Americans have never heard of. It's called the State Policy Network, and we've been doing a lot of work over the past 2 years exposing the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is known as ALEC, which actually puts the bills, corporate-crafted bills, directly in the hands of lawmakers at ALEC's conventions and resort meetings. And ALEC allows corporate lobbyists to vote alongside elected officials. What we discovered was that it wasn't just corporate lobbyists voting as part of these closed-door meetings at ALEC. It was also special interest groups from this thing called SPN. It turns out that while ALEC has more than $7 million it spends each year, SPN backstops that spending with another $83 million of spending in the states to try to brand this junk legislation, basically to advance the corporate agenda, as local by creating think tanks in every state in the country to try to push this legislation and create statistics or cooked books in some ways to try to promote this legislation.
And what is this group, the State Policy Network's relationship to another group called the Texas Conservative Coalition Research Institute, which have successfully stopped Medicaid expansion in the state of Texas? Ted Cruz worked for the organization, and apparently they are also a part of this sort of network of dark money.
Well, I'm not as familiar with their operations, but I do know that there are a couple of similar groups in Texas, and Ted Cruz's hand has had his hand in a few of them, including the Texas Public Policy Foundation, TPPF, which is part of ALEC and a long time part of ALEC, and where Cruz, before he went to Congress and almost shut down the United States government this fall, where he was there trying to devise, cook up new ways to stop the Affordable Care Act and stop more Americans from getting coverage under that act to provide, better access for people. For example, that what that act does is provide better access for people who have pre-existing conditions and for young adults who are no longer in school but who need help on their parents' insurance. And so while that program has been vilified in all sorts of ways, Ted Cruz, before he ever went to the United States Senate, was working with some of these think tanks or other operations to try to stop this and other policies that have been designed to help ordinary Americans.
Yeah, actually, I did mean the TPPF. The other one is a newer spinoff, the Texas Conservative Coalition Research Institute. But these institutes are proliferating, and obviously the Kochs have endless resources since they're, the fourth and fifth richest, I think, in the country. And then you've got the Walton family following them. So what is the sense what's the countervailing? Obviously, you don't have the money, but how can you fight this good fight to try and level the playing field, or at least alert the American people to the extent to which their democracy is being bought out from under them?
Well, we don't have the money on our side, but I do think we've got the truth on our side. And so, for example, for TPPF, that's one of these what we call stink tanks, and we jointly issued a report in Texas with the Progress Now affiliate in Texas about these stink tanks. It's available on stinktanks.org for every state in the country if you want to check it out, if people want to find out if there's a stink tank near you that's distorting policy or getting uncritically quoted in your local newspaper or on local TV. You can find it at that site. What we discovered in part in our research was that groups like TPPF, part of the State Policy Network, are not just receiving checks from the Koch family foundations, but some of them are also receiving direct checks from David Koch himself. And as you mentioned, he's one of the richest men in America, but he's also one of the richest billionaires in the world. And so it's not just that that it's a $100,000 grant to fund the operations. It's his personal investment in these groups to advance his his personal agenda to remake America in a way that's very different than how it currently looks, in ways that I think are dramatically worse for most Americans. And so we think, even though there's big money that is out there that we're trying to expose for these groups that are doing what I would call stealth lobbying, not reporting it, getting a tax break for doing it, we think that the American people are waking up to this. More and more Americans are concerned about it, and rightly so, and we're trying to help make sure they have the information and the facts they need.
And, of course, the Koch brothers, with all of their money, are essentially having you know, last time around they very effectively, through Karl Rove and others, have managed to bring about the Republican majority in 2010 in the Congress, and they're funding all of the obstruction that's going on. And essentially, at the end of the day, they and also Rupert Murdoch, by the way, they're working overtime to deny global warming, which is a global problem. You know, Rupert Murdoch's second biggest shareholders in News Corporation are the Kingdom Fund, which is the Saudi Arabian royal family. So it's not surprising that they're against global warming, since they're in the petrochemical business. So they're very active, these handful of billionaires, at both at the national, state, and local level.
Well, that's right. And I think really one of the greatest pieces of propaganda that these guys, in essence, help fund or subsidize or underwrite is the climate denial machine. The fact is that regardless of what people are reading as a result of the propaganda that's being pushed by entities that they've funded, as well as other entities that the American Petroleum Institute and others have funded, the fact is that 97% of reputable scientists across the globe, out of a survey of, you know, thousands of scientifically peer-reviewed articles, believe that global warming is happening and it's man-made, and it's a crisis that threatens our very existence, quite frankly, over the next few decades and century. And these guys are profiting big time from their oil and oil-related businesses. They have invested a huge amount, along with Exxon and others, in the climate denial operation. And these SPN groups, these state policy networks that are so uncritically quoted in the local press when they're testifying before the state houses or when they're weighing in on bills, let alone ALEC, which had the audacity recently to have a seminar for lawmakers to indoctrinate them that basically increased carbon dioxide is good for you. That was their pitch. They're continuing their assault on the EPA. That's being pushed in Congress as well, to deny the EPA any power, the Environmental Protection Agency, any power to address carbon and carbon dioxide and its effect on our environment, on our climate. These are really pernicious policies. The fact is that they are policies that serve their policies and policy agenda, propaganda that serve the bottom line of the Kochs and of some of these enormous oil companies and coal companies. And I think the American people are ultimately going to wake up to the fact that they've been lied to and that the lies have been funded by these guys.
And again, I'm speaking with Lisa Graves, Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy and the publisher of ALEC Exposed, PRWatch.org. Sourcewatch.org, where she just released an expose of Pete Peterson and his campaign to fix the debt. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts. So given that you've got Kraft Foods and Searle Pharmaceuticals behind the state policy network, along with the Koch's funding, if you put all those people together as consumers and decided to boycott their products because they're trying to basically destroy the planet or thwart efforts to save the planet from global warming, you've got Dixie cups, Brawny paper towels, Kraft Foods, Searle Pharmaceuticals. Is that a valid strategy?
Well, I think that there are a lot of folks and activists who are calling for making, you know, consumer choices that don't fund evil in some ways, to paraphrase Google's claims, which we've also just recently written about in terms of what it's been funding on the far right in this country. With respect to Sterile Pharmaceuticals, they were subsequently bought out by Monsanto and then sort of bought out again by Pfizer. The money that is coming to the Sterile Foundation is coming from the personal wealth of the Sterile family to advance through their foundation to advance this really extreme agenda. What we discovered in some ways with the SPN research, the State Policy Network research that we launched several weeks ago after a soft launch earlier this year, is that the Kochs are not the biggest funder of that operation. There are some other big funders that are bigger than them, and also some of these big corporations that ought to really rethink backing a group that has such an array of extreme policies. But I think consumers ought to make better choices. They shouldn't put their money behind corporations and corporations controlled by individuals who are trying to privatize our public schools and really get rid of public schools. Privatize Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, as with ALEC, push and peddle global warming denial lies and propaganda. They really ought to hold those corporations accountable.
Is there any other corporations that that consumers could boycott, like Kraft Foods?
Well, Kraft, it's interesting. Kraft dropped out of ALEC, and then next thing you know, this fall, when we were looking into the State Policy Network, there it was, right there on the same placard. We saw one of the SPN activists tweeting out. It was right there on the placard, right next to Facebook, right next to ALEC. So we actually have a list of all the corporations on our site that we know that fund SPN. You can find that at prwatch.org. And you can also find more about that also at the thinktanks.org site that we've co-launched. And so there are a number of companies that are public-facing that people might want to think about whether they want to buy their products if they're going to back these sort of groups that are pushing such extreme and ridiculous policies in many regards.
Well, just in closing, Lisa Graves, tell us about, I know about Pete Peterson and the billionaire from Wall Street who's been funding all of the skies falling because of the deficits, which also happen to be going down. What have you exposed about him?
Well, what we've done is track the money, basically. This is a guy who's, very old and has committed to spending, hundreds of millions of dollars, literally well over $100 million, to try to privatize Social Security any way he can. This is a really, I think he's a guy who is behaving in an unconscionable way. This is a billionaire who will never need Social Security. Why he has such an ideological hatred of Social Security is beyond me. It's more the Koch brothers, privatization, crony capitalism, survival of the fittest, Ayn Rand sort of junk that we've been seeing coming out of some of these really elite, so-called elite billionaires. He's funded a bunch of front groups, and these front groups are out there peddling the same sort of tired ideas, repackaged as brand new, through groups like Fix the Debt. You can find out more about Fix the Debt on our site. You can reach that on our SourceWatch site or through prwatch.org. We've helped expose the Fix the Debt CEOs. So it's a group that Pete Peterson has funded through some of his other groups. They've recruited CEOs across the country to back this so-called reasonable plan compromise on the debt or deficit. Turns out these CEOs are trying to protect their profits overseas from being taxed, or changing the tax laws to make sure that they're actually paying their fair share of taxes. When we looked at a number of those corporations, turned out they weren't. In essence, some of them had negative tax rates as compared with ordinary Americans who don't, who pay, 30-40% in taxes every year. Some of these CEOs are paying themselves enormous salaries through their, shareholder decisions, enormous salaries at a time when they're calling for austerity policies for ordinary Americans. They ought to be ashamed of themselves. People ought to take a look at those corporations, too, and see if they want to do business with them.
Well, Lisa Graves, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much, Ian. Thanks for having me on, and I really appreciate it. Sorry I was a little bit hard to reach. It's a joy to be on your show.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Lisa Graves, Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy and the publisher of ALEC-Exposed.org, PRWatch.org, and SourceWatch.org. She just released an expose of Pete Peterson, his campaign to fix the debt, and she served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for Nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a Deputy Chief for the U.S. Court. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the latest activities of the Koch brothers. Happiness.
my whole family. Just keep your phony culture warm
and keep your fucking tea.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining me in the studio now is Amardeep Kaleka, who is an Emmy Award-winning film director who, following his father's murder in the Wisconsin Sikh temple shooting of 2012, became involved in gun control and new legislation to reduce hate crimes. He is running for the United States House of Representatives in Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District to unseat Representative Paul Ryan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Amardeep Kaleka.
Thank you, Ian, for having me.
And, of course, your father was slain at the Oak Creek Temple in Wisconsin, and along with five others of his congregation, in a mass shooting by a white supremacist on August the 12th of 2012. And also, this white supremacist, when the police arrived, he shot a police officer 15 times. He survived, I take it, the policeman.
He did. Lieutenant Brian Murphy survived, and my father had a hard-fought battle with the gunman with a little bit of a fruit knife, and he fought him off, and the gunman left immediately after that battle and didn't shoot anybody else except for Lieutenant Brian Murphy and then himself.
So, in effect, your father's probably saved the lives of a lot of congregants, right?
We think so. We hope so.
Right. But since then, we've had other mass shootings. Of course, this is the one-year anniversary of the Newtown School massacre. It must be hard for you to get your head around the idea of why does this keep happening? And in spite of the outpourings of anguish every time it happens, the whole nation is outraged, and yet nothing is done. So what's your understanding of that disconnect?
Well, it's complex. Immediately following August 5th, I went into intense meditation and thinking about this process, and then Sandy Hook happened, and we were asked to come out there and then be part of a coalition of survivors from Columbine, Virginia Tech, Sandy Hook, all our friends now, and we've become a family that most often you don't want to have a family like that. We always say it's the family you don't want to have. But over the past year now, we've done a documentary called Peacemakers, where we follow each of these people from these different tragedies, and we allow them to analyze why America has become so insanely violent. And the violence is different. It's not bred from just economic disparity. Like in these situations in America where we're a highly developed nation, it's bred on hate. On racism, on hate, on classism, on, you know, conspiracy theories gone wrong, whatever the case right. may be.
Well, of course, and conspiracy theories exist on both the left and the right. And this idiot shooter, the white supremacist, thought that somehow because Sikhs wear turbans, they were, what, the Ayatollah or something? What can you figure out there? But wasn't
I can give you a couple of things. He was a former Army sergeant, was let go. So I think he did know the difference between Muslims and Sikhs. But there is that cross discrepancy, or, you know, maybe he was confused, but I think he was trying to start a race war. That's essentially what his lyrics and his music state.
I see.
And he thought to himself, well, let's attack the Sikhs because they're so militant and they fought in so many gallantly in so many wars. Hmm. So what if we attack them? They're going to attack us and then we start this race war. But instead, what we decided to do was turn the other cheek in a very Christian way and say, hey, let's work towards peace.
And this started you on a journey into politics, right?
Yeah.
You're a filmmaker, right?
Absolutely. After that documentary, I came to face-to-face with a number of congressmen, number of senators, and started to realize that the problem is far deeper than meets the eye. It's systemic. It's the governance of our whole nation. It's the idea that people become bipartisan and push far left or push far right, and then there's no middle ground, and people are battling even rhetorically on the Hill and shutting down the government, which affects all of us economically, but they don't have to live with it. They don't have to go to the inner city. We come from the inner city. They don't have to go there. And so that's what launched me into this idea or a thought process of maybe running for a seat. And then I was asked several times for a state assembly seat from both sides. And I just thought to myself that I would rather do something nationally. And that's the seat came about. It could be one of the 17 that gets flipped. Originally, it was not thought to
You're
be.
You're talking about the Congressman Paul Ryan's seat.
Yeah. Originally, it wasn't thought to be a flippable seat.
Right.
But in the R3 region, when the polling came back, people started looking at it and saying, well, if it's only 3 percentage points lead to a Republican, and other ones are 5, 10, 12, mm-hmm. I mean, who can we put there? And who can run this? And I raised my hand a couple of times.
Again, I'm speaking with Amardeep Kaleka, who's an Emmy Award-winning film director who, following his father's murder in the Wisconsin Sikh temple shooting of 2012, became involved in gun control and new legislation to reduce hate crimes. He's running for the United States House of Representatives in Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District to unseat Representative Paul Ryan. And, of course, the very polarity and dysfunction from partisanship and ultra-partisanship is manifested in the primary system. And, you know, if you're a Democrat, then in a curious way, the best thing that happened to the Democrats is this civil war within the Republicans between the Tea Party and the traditional Republicans, and it plays out in the primary process. How but you're entering that very same primary process on the Democratic side, right?
I am.
And what's your sense then of how you, as you're not white.
I'll be the first.
You're not Christian. You're not a gun-toting deer hunter. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Mm. Most people in Wisconsin are. I'm just trying to paint a picture here of an uphill battle.
Oh, no, it's definitely uphill. We are hunters. We hunt tigers in India, and we hunt deer in India, like our ancestry. So we're very well versed in guns and coming from an Army ROTC background where they would make me the point man with my M16, I had some training, you know. And so I'm not gun-toting, let's say that. And, of course, I've fought for gun legislation, which I think every American should fight for because illegal guns are what we're all fighting, right?
And well, also the intersection between mentally ill people and easy access to firearms. That is the pathology, the diagnosis behind all of these mass shootings, almost without exception, that you find you, at the end of the day, that's what you find it's about. And,
absolutely.
And that is one of these most outrageous things that the NRA are blocking.
It seems to be because everybody thinks there's a slippery slope on legislation, where if you just pass one, it's going to change everything. But I venture to show people, and the American government is not moving that fast on anything. Let's look at, you know, pro-life versus pro-choice. Takes us 40 years, Roe versus Wade afterwards, and we're still arguing the same thing. Nothing is going to slip and change that fast. It is an uphill battle in the primary and in the general in Wisconsin District 1 because you're right. I'll be the first person that's not white to even run in that district. Mm-hmm. I'll be, though we're very religious, I'm not Christian. Mm-hmm. And candidates usually, especially Paul Ryan, that's what he does. He can speak at pulpits. He can speak.
He does, and he claims to be a very devout Catholic. At the same time, I've interviewed Sister Simone Campbell, who led the nuns on the bus, who went to his district office and said, "How can you be a good Catholic and believe in Ayn Rand's peculiar Darwinian philosophy?"
I agree. I think. Whenever I talk to Christians, I quote, you know, Samuel 1, chapter 17 of David and Goliath. And it seems to be all of us as Americans are in this situation where Goliath is, at that time with the Philistines, you know, the Goliath was a 7-foot guy. For us, Goliath is all these negative things that are coming out of all our society and whether it be warring or the, you know, prison system, how tough it's gotten, whether it be a lack of education or trying to focus on it. But essentially, I believe that all of us as Americans need the David to come in the room, and that would be the people. We need the people to be represented in Congress. And that seems to be the missing aspect right now.
Well, isn't that largely because Congress has been taken over by money?
You know, it's largely because
you're going to have to raise money, right?
I'm going to have to raise a lot. I'm going to have to – he's already sitting on probably $2 million around there from just the last campaign.
$70,000 plus from the Koch brothers.
Oh, yeah, the Koch brothers. Right. So the money you got to think of it like this. In 1972, the middle class made a certain amount of money. Now, 2012, we all know the middle class is making less and less money when you take into all these accounts, the inflation rate, the healthcare costs, everything else. We're making far less than we ever have been. Essentially, then, campaign finance has skyrocketed. So how can somebody from the middle class actually go to Congress to represent that idea? So trade unions are going to be attacked, which they are, especially in Wisconsin. Education is going to be attacked because who uses education? Who uses public education? I'm a product of public education. We grew up in the inner city and we were given government housing and we got, you know, free lunch and we got a little bit of welfare support. And these middle class ideals, which equal and level the playing field, that's what we need to protect.
So we started out, of course, talking about Nelson Mandela, who, you know, can't turn on the television or hear the radio without eulogies, which all of which are well-deserved. But there was, of course, an interesting role for South Africans of Indian descent, not the least of which was Gandhi himself. And they were under that kind of Nazi system of apartheid. They were in the colored category. And then, of course, when the South African government started to trade a lot with Japan, and they had to figure out were the Japanese white or colored. So they decided that the Japanese were white, but the Chinese were colored.
That was the dividing line. I was just in South Africa, I think, 2 years ago, and Mandiba, I went to Soweto, and I went to go, see his house, and it brings you shivers to see how middle class and lower class he was, but how powerful he became after such a long battle. And the Gandhi connection is very apt, and not many people do know that he studied law school and became a lawyer in South Africa and then moved back to India. And with this idea, where he saw the racism and the apartheid movement and thought of it, oh my God, it's India. It's a mirror. Mm-hmm. And that same classism, racism, still exists all around our nation or all around our planet in different ways, you know. So Mandiba, like Mandela, he's, to this day, like when you go to South Africa and you see those big statues of him, I mean, he's larger than life. Mm-hmm. And though he's died, I think he'll live on in all of our practices.
And again, I'm joined in the studio by Amardeep Kaleka, who is an Emmy Award-winning film director who, following his father's murder at the Wisconsin Sikh Temple in 2012, became involved in gun control and new legislation, and he's running for the United States House of Representatives to unseat Representative Paul Ryan in Wisconsin's 1st District. Back to the issue of gun control in the last couple of minutes here, Amar, tell me, I mean, this is talk about an uphill battle. I mean, you had all of that momentum. The president was told not to go near it. The Democrats had decided not to touch this issue. Yet President Obama was so deeply upset by what happened to those school children that he felt he couldn't remain silent and really stuck his neck out, pushed it as hard as he could, and yet it went down. And it shows you that how much money and minority rule actually operates in the U.S. Democracy.
Absolutely. The NRA grading system. We just put an introduction out to Wayne LaPierre just so we can go skeet shooting together, because there's this discussion. It's not a black or white issue. It seems like when you're bipartisan, everything is black and white. And people say that the gun legislation was the tipping point. That's the button that pushed the government shutdown, because then everybody looked at each other at such a critical junction of the Constitution, and then they wouldn't cross over on sides. Now, with gun legislation, I mean, as Sandy Hook's one-year anniversary approaches, and they're going to have a big event in D.C. Coming up for it, as it approaches, I think we all need to understand and comprehend we're fighting illegal guns. Nobody is fighting to take the guns out of legal hands. We understand if you live, 100 miles away from another city and you have to protect your land, that's different. You've probably have, filed the proper paperwork and done everything.
But let's face it, you don't need to protect your land in the 21st century. I mean, even indeed when the Native Americans were massacred, arguably, there were other ways to deal with that. The white people were actually stealing the land. But, you know, I mean, that's the part of it that I want to get a handle on this. And since I come from a different culture, where in Australia, you know, if manly men get into a fight, the last thing they do is pull out a gun. It's considered the most abject act of cowardice.
Absolutely.
Why is it in our culture that guns are considered heroic and manly and a way to settle problems?
Simple. Military-industrial complex. This nation was founded 200 years ago on warring and building guns and selling them and selling cannons and tanks and all these things. And the gun sales, capitalism in general, me and you both know if you plant a seed of certain capitalistic, let's say, invention, if it's a bicycle or if it's a car, it's going to grow. And so America, because it founded the idea or the usage of this many guns, you know, to fight, let's say, the Native Americans or fight different colonial rule or these types of things.
And then, of course, the Maxim machine gun was invented in America, the Gatling gun.
The Gatling, yeah. And there's guns that we will never see, you and I, you know, Department of Defense guns that you and I will never even touch or even hear about that get sold to a faraway nation. And that simple thing can be curbed by Congress, can be curbed by D.C., because it's our money, it's our taxpayer money that goes there.
But what about the psychological aspect? What about changing the young boys? And the movie industry here is culpable, and so is the television business in terms of every TV series is just endless guns and these silly little women holding big guns that supposedly be FBI officers.
Well, just remember that, you know, even when people product place Coca-Cola, there is a certain amount of influence in Hollywood from people who have money that are gun salesmen, you know, and sometimes that's our own government. Sometimes that's just capitalistic people who are quite intelligent at making money.
I see. Well, that's true. The NRA is actually the lobbying group for the arms and ammunition manufacturers.
I'm glad you said it. I couldn't.
Well, you better. I mean, you got to win over those deer hunters.
Yeah, well, I love deer hunting. So we're gonna go after. We're gonna do some skeet shooting tournaments and definitely go after some deer.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Amardeep Kaleka, who is an Emmy Award-winning film director who, following his father's murder in the Wisconsin Sikh temple shooting of 2012, became involved in gun control and new legislation to reduce hate crimes. He is running for the United States House of Representatives in Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District to unseat Representative Paul Ryan. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer David Rushert. This program is available for podcast at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Yeah,